Good afternoon, everyone, and good morning to our friends on the West Coast. Welcome to the inaugural call for the Real Assets Advisor, the Real Alternative Insights in partnership with the Investment Program Association and Real Assets Advisor. I'm Ken Montgomery, and I'm Director of Education for the Investment Program Association. Many of you probably found out about this call through Real Assets Advisor, so just by way of introduction, the IPA advocates for financial advisors, for broker-dealers, and investment managers on portfolio diversifying investments, and we do that across a wide range of asset classes. Today we're going to focus on two of those, so real estate and debt, and we'll do that through closed-end interval funds. So we're really excited about the kickoff of this series. We will be having a call every first Thursday of each month. So our next one will be February 1st, and we'll do that at 1 o'clock Central, 2 o'clock Eastern each month. So we hope you'll make it a regularly scheduled part of your education. Thanks for joining us. There are a couple of ways to keep up with the Investment Program Association and Real Assets Advisor. One way you can do that is through Twitter. You can follow us at IPA Direct Invest, and then you can follow Real Assets Advisor at Real Assets ADV. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, so that's the Investment Program Association, and Institutional Real Estate, Inc. is a good way to follow Real Assets Advisor on LinkedIn. That will take you to all of the publications. I'll ask you as we go along to chat any questions you might have. You can do that with the chat function on the webinar. So what you'll do is just send me, Ken Montgomery, the question. I'll hang on to those until the end, and then at that point, I'll pose those to all of our panelists. You can also download and view fact sheets for each of the funds that we're going to talk about today. We have three different investment managers, investment sponsors, and you'll have an opportunity to look at each one of the five funds that we'll reference. We won't talk about them in detail, but we'll reference those. And that's just an opportunity for you to get additional information if it's helpful. So with that in mind, I will now introduce our moderator, who will go ahead and introduce the remaining panel. Mike Consul is the editor of Real Assets Advisor, and many of you have probably seen the publication for this month and know that Mike is focusing on interval funds. So we're excited to kick this off. And with that, Mike, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you, Ken, and hello to our audience, and thank you for joining us. We are also joined, as Ken referenced, by our group of participating experts who I'll introduce alphabetically and briefly so that we can get on with the questions about the topic at hand post-haste and hopefully allow plenty of time for audience questions as well. With me are Randy Anderson, President of Griffin Capital Asset Management and Chief Economist of Griffin Capital Company. John Guthrie is Managing Director of Product and Marketing for Pravasi Capital Partners. Justin Milberg is Managing Director of Resource Financial Fund Management, where he directs investment strategy. We are here to talk about the startling rise of the closed-end interval fund, which, let's face it, is one of the hot investment products in the private wealth market these days. And just to give you some sense of scale, I will quote a few numbers from an article about the rise of interval funds that appears in the newly released February edition of Real Assets Advisor magazine that is just hitting mailboxes and desktops this week. Consider that since the advent of the interval fund in 2014, there are now nearly 40 active interval funds with $17.4 billion in assets currently under management and billions more looking to be raised by more than 20 other interval funds that are currently in registration. So impressive numbers to be sure. We'll begin with some basic structural elements, though, that make closed-end interval funds attractive to product designers and sponsors, as well as financial advisors and investors. We'll keep things alphabetical with Randy Johnson of Griffin Capital. I'll call on you to field that first discussion point. Randy, describe the purpose of the closed-end fund structure and what makes it an attractive vehicle for varied asset classes.
Well, first of all, thank you, Ken and Mike, for putting this on. We really appreciate the opportunity to speak to a wide audience and the coverage that we're getting from both of your firms. You know, when you think about interval funds, you know, I always like to start out with the real basics. Interval fund feels a lot like a mutual fund to investors. We as sponsors, we raise money every day. We make investments every day. And at the end of that day, we have a new net asset value. The only real difference is that we stand ready to provide liquidity. And in most cases, that liquidity is not on a daily basis. It's on a quarterly basis. And when you provide liquidity on a quarterly basis and you don't have to stand ready to provide it daily, you get a lot more portfolio flexibility and you can do a lot of things that people want and desire from their alternative investments. So what have people traditionally sought from their alternative investments? They've traditionally sought higher income levels, the ability to get some appreciation, but maybe most importantly, the ability to have low volatility and low correlation to the broader markets. And again, when you don't have to have full liquid securities in your portfolio, we've been able to, as the sponsors on this phone and other sponsors that you referenced as part of that $17.4 billion, put together a lot of products that have those types of characteristics, largely high-income products with very, very low volatility compared to the alternatives that you would see in the peer space. Plus, you get some other benefits. One, you get daily pricing for transparency. Most of the alts, you know, you might have to wait 4, 5, 6, 7 years in order to understand or realize the value that you get. With that daily pricing and transparency, it's also hard to do if the fee structure is too large or too high. So largely these fee propositions for interval funds are typically smaller than you would see in traditional alternative investments in the real estate or high yield debt space. And there's a reasonable amount of liquidity, which is nice. You know, people have things that happen. It's a good event, you need money. It's a bad event, you need money. You don't have to sit and wait for this sponsor to say, listen, it's time for a liquidity event where you merge or sell assets or get those things back. Your assets do have an ability, a reasonably strong ability to get liquidity. And like I say, most people are offering up a minimum of 5% per quarter, which is a minimum of 20% per year. And that's a pretty reasonable amount of liquidity as we sit here today. So this structure has really led to really nice product design, and that product design has really created to the benefit of the individual investor.
So, Randy, I think you hit on two of the ingredients in the secret sauce of these interval funds, that semi-liquid, semi-illiquid fund structure, in addition to the low minimums, the ranging typically from $2,500 to $25,000. John Guthrie, let's talk about which asset classes are particularly attractive for the closed-end fund structure.
Sure. Love to. I'm going to take it from a couple of different angles. One is that most asset classes or underlying investments fit pretty nicely in a closed-end fund structure, in a closed-end fund interval fund structure. Some are a little bit more challenging than others, and I think we're going to talk about real estate a little bit later, but direct real estate can be a little bit more challenging than others. We think that private debt is a very attractive investment for an interval fund structure or a closed-end fund structure, and we have both corporate debt and residential debt represented in interval funds. But if you look at the far ends of the conversation, on one end you have private funds, which can invest in asset classes or underlying investments, you know, without much concern for liquidity at all, and an interval fund does have liquidity requirements. They're less than a mutual fund, but it does have liquidity requirements. So you have to make sure that the asset classes you're looking at are going to provide that liquidity and the ability to price on a regular basis as well, as Randy pointed out. But if you look on the other side of the spectrum, if you look at the mutual fund world, I think that's where things are really highlighted and become attractive. Because in a mutual fund, your liquidity needs are much higher than an interval fund and certainly than in a traditional tender offer closed-end fund. And because of that, mutual funds are limited significantly in terms of which assets and asset classes and underlying investments they can actually hold in their fund, or at least or at least to any significant degree. So I think that's the real interesting point here, is that move from mutual fund to interval fund opens up a level of or ability to invest in securities with less liquidity that really expands the horizon and benefits investors at the end of the day.
You know, you mentioned debt or credit, and one of the questions I'm asking a lot of financial experts this year is, 2018 going to be the year of debt, or is it going to be or credit, debt slash credit, or of equity? And let's just go around our panel real quickly. I'm kind of putting you on the spot to pick one side or the other, but starting with you, Randy Anderson, is this year going to be debt or equity as the primary component or kind of riding herd this year for investment portfolios?
Sure. Well, I mean, the question obviously has some nuances in there. I mean, largely, you know, we're expecting relatively strong GDP growth, particularly with the passing of the Tax Act. And under those circumstances, that's generally a market that's favorable to equity. That's also a market that would be favorable to equity on not just a corporate side, but also on the real estate side. So whether it's private or public real estate or whether it's the stock market, you know, equity is going to be, you know, our first choice over debt. Now, with debt, you know, it's going to be a very challenging environment to buy, I would say, typical debt that's got typical duration because of the growing economy and largely what the Fed's going to do. And now the global markets are kind of more on board with a sort of coordinated central bank policy that's likely to finally make the 10-year treasury start to rise and move closer to that 3% number over the year. Traditional fixed income is not going to work. What's going to work in fixed income is being able to look globally for certain markets where rates and spreads might compress. It's able to invest in direct originated loans where the sector or the company is able to grow their earnings and their EBITDA. And so it's a sharpshooter's market, and there's going to be very, very good opportunities there. But just generically going out and buying credit with duration is where some challenges, I think, will be in 2018.
John Guthrie, how about you, debt or equity?
Sure. I suspect there's room for both. And outside of the interval fund space, we certainly have a lot of real estate equity hitting the market in the form of daily or monthly NAV REITs, as I'm sure you've noticed. I don't disagree with Randy's short-term look at the market. I think there is some momentum behind the economy at the moment. I would say that. And you did ask about 2018, so that might be fair. But I would take a little bit longer view and say that, you know, at the end of the day, we're pretty far along in an economic recovery, and markets have rallied quite nicely through, you know, at least the last three quarters of that recovery. And if you take that and you then look at valuations and you in whatever form you want to, I think the longer term look at equity is maybe a little bit more challenging compared to debt, where you're going to have I think a little bit more stability in pricing if the markets do begin to get a little rockier. So I think there's room for both, and in terms of Randy's comments about where in the debt markets you want to be invested, I think we agree. I think you don't want to be making duration bets at this point as yields might begin to rise, but there are a lot of private investment, corporate and residential debt markets, mortgage markets that where we think there's a lot of attractive yield and opportunity.
So, Justin Milberg, no doubt there's going to be room for both in a portfolio, but what say you on the debt equity question? Which one do you think makes the most sense to be trending in 2018?
Let me skirt that question a little bit because I can't disagree with Randy and Jonathan on 2018. But bringing this back to interval funds, I will say that alternative investments, the allocations investors are making to alternative investments are not just a pure return oriented investment decision. As Randy highlighted in his comments, one of the key drivers for investment in alternatives are volatility. And when you look to where interval funds are primarily investing within the broader debt or credit markets, they are primarily investing in loans. And all of these words tend to become interchangeable, but on Wall Street, loans is a term of art that reflects that primarily comprises credit instruments issued by private companies. And those credit instruments are almost always floating rate. And we think that an allocation in a portfolio to floating rate debt is a great place to be in a rising interest rate environment. And we do think we're in a rising interest rate environment. The credit side of the equation gives you both downside protection that Randy and Jonathan referred to, but also volatility protection as the yields on these instruments rise with rates. And I think that is really fundamental. So I'm not disagreeing. I think we're all in agreement that probably just on a pure return basis, the equity markets are likely to surpass this year, but that it still makes a lot of sense to allocate a portion of the portfolio to floating rate debt instruments that are going to provide excellent return and really moderate volatility within a portfolio.
So, Justin Milberg, we'll stay with you on this next question. What are the advantages of the structure? What advantages of the structure of a closed-end interval fund accrue to the end investor?
And again, my two co-panelists have walked through a lot of the advantages of the product structure and the types of assets that can best be leveraged within that product structure. When we talk about the advantages, I think it's helpful to discuss it in the context of other approaches that retail investors may have to accessing the alternative market. So obviously a lot of dollars have flowed in the last 5 years into non-traded products, both on the real estate and credit side, since we're focused on those two asset classes on this call. And when we think about the comparison of interval funds and the non-traded products, each offers certain advantages and disadvantages. We're a sponsor, and Griffin is a sponsor of a broad range of products that provide access to alternatives for retail investors. What we like about the interval fund are the increased liquidity that Randy talked about, but there are some other interesting advantages to investors that come from a 40 Act structure. Again, as Randy said, these behave a lot like mutual funds other than the quarterly versus daily liquidity. And I think one of the key benefits is transparency. We mark our portfolios to market every day. So some of the issues that came up with non-traded REITs over distributions, not the products sponsored by the panelists here, but some of those issues are eliminated. If we were to over distribute, that would be reflected in NAV the next day. We all publish our full list of investments on a quarterly basis. So that is another example of the types of transparency. The 40 Act provisions also prevent any investments with affiliates. So all of the protections that an investor would expect from a traditional mutual fund investment come along with the 40 Act structure that regulates the interval funds. We cannot turn off liquidity. In a lot of the non-traded products, liquidity is at the option of the sponsor. Our 5% liquidity obligation is embedded in our prospectus, and anyone that did not meet that obligation would expect action from the SEC. So there are a number of advantages here. And then ultimately, the most important advantage, of course, is a very efficient manner of accessing alternative investments. So capturing that lower volatility and higher return with a modest amount of liquidity, transparency, and some of the other features that have been discussed so far.
Randy Anderson, back to you. How might the closed-end fund structure provide a solution for advisory fee-based accounts?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question. In fact, I would also turn to the data and tell you that the majority of the money that we've raised have been for portfolio allocations and fee-based accounts. I mean, the first thing is, I think from a good product design point of view, you know, we should recognize that these are perpetual vehicles. And these are vehicles that should be built with the long term in mind. In other words, if you're sitting out there and looking at a mixed asset portfolio, the old days of 60-40 stocks and bonds, now we're going to start to add alternatives. Are these products that we're building products that should be part of a long-term diversified portfolio? And I would say largely the products that have come to market, the answer is yes to that. They're products that make sense and they fit the shape of the economy over different cycles and will lead to better risk-adjusted returns for investors. So we want something that people want to put in their portfolio as a long-term hold. So, for example, on our real estate side, we've got both high-quality public real estate investment trust, but we also have investments in very high quality private real estate funds. And over the long haul, having both public and private real estate together in a portfolio with stocks and bonds has shown to really increase the returns and reduce the risk of a portfolio. The beautiful thing about the structure is it makes it a lot easier for the advisor to allocate. You know, when people are building these models for their clients, on a quarterly basis, they actually go back and reset and reallocate the models. Without the ability to have liquidity, it's hard for them to add a little bit to real estate if they're a little low on their real estate allocation. If real estate starts to run and all of a sudden real estate's too high in their model, they have the ability to trim that type of portfolio. Without that liquidity provision, it's very, very difficult to do. And in fact, there's some firms that would argue that non-traded products that you don't have the ability to manage aren't actually even suitable for the advisory account, because charging an asset-based management fee when you can't really manage those assets when you invest in them may or may not be appropriate for those types of accounts. So we think they're very appropriate for the accounts. We think they help increase the risk-adjusted return and the efficient frontier. And we largely think that the majority of dollars raised for these interval funds are likely to come from accounts as people are putting these in as part of their model portfolios for clients.
Okay, well put. John Guthrie, over to you. The closed-end fund predates the interval fund. It's been around longer than before the interval fund was dreamed up. So what are the differences between a conventional closed-end fund and a closed-end interval fund?
Sure, and If you use the 1940 Act as a backdrop for both, they both have the same basic investor protections that I think have been described pretty well already, right? Very difficult to do transactions with affiliates, et cetera. Leverage is limited beyond which it would be so in a private investment. So you have a backdrop of both that's pretty similar. The difference is that Rule 23C-3 allowed for repurchases. So you go from a closed-end fund, which really has much more control over its liquidity. The tender offer funds can have liquidity provisions, but they can also decide to stop offering that liquidity. The interval fund, on the other hand, has liquidity provisions that I think Randy listed what is typically done, which is 5% a quarter, and interval funds really have to meet those provisions. So there's not much room to not meet those liquidity provisions. Now, for investors, you know, you can look at each one of those things. They each have positives and negatives. So we have both, right? We have a traditional tender offer closed-end fund. We have two interval funds, and we offer open-end mutual funds as well. But that additional liquidity does provide more assurity to the investor that they can get liquidity from their fund on a regular basis. However, it also means that you have to adjust how you manage the fund, and you illiquid assets have to be taken into account in an interval fund. So you have to be more thoughtful about portfolio construction to make sure that when liquidity is requested, you will be able to deliver it. In a tender offer fund, you have the chance to manage to a more illiquid portfolio, which can, at the end of the day, if done appropriately, drive returns that are greater than a portfolio that has to be more liquid. So that's one of the differences. I would say that also getting relief on share classes on interval funds is much easier. So in terms of, we're just talking about advisory accounts, for an interval fund, it's much easier to structure share classes that fit within advisory accounts. That can be more challenging for a more traditional closed-end fund, et cetera. So I think I covered most of the things. Back to you.
Well, John, I'm going to stay with you on this next question as well, because I want to know what considerations might a product manufacturer factor in when choosing between a closed-end fund and a closed-end interval fund?
Sure, sure. So I think you just sort of take the comments I just made and flip them around, and you come to those answers, right? You have to, a product manufacturer would look at the underlying assets that they want to invest in. Do they fit well in the fund? Are they going to have enough liquidity to fit in an interval fund? If not, you might consider a more traditional tender offer closed-end fund. You would look at the assets again and say, are you going to be able to value them on a regular basis frequently enough to work for an interval fund? So they have to be, we all talk about, you know, we all speak about illiquid assets. So we want to get, want to use assets that can generate alpha over where you're going to be able to generate alpha in an open-end mutual fund in many cases. And those assets are all often illiquid, but they're also often harder to value than funds that are, or securities that are traded on an exchange. For an interval fund, you have to make sure that the assets that you are investing in can be valued frequently enough that you can provide a regular NAV as is required. And then I think you want to look at where you're going to be selling the fund, which is also important. And we've talked about share classes, and you can provide different share classes on an interval fund more easily than you can on a traditional closed-end tender offer fund. And that decision can also drive which structure you want to use. If you're going to be targeting RIAs, which might want an iShare, or to fit it more easily in a traditional model, you're probably going to want to look at the interval fund structure. If you're targeting either more commission-based advisors or maybe high-net-worth advisors who aren't going to worry as much about the share class issue in an advisory account, the traditional closed-end fund might work better. So it's really, I want to stay away from suggesting that one is better than the other. It's a series of trade-offs in terms of which assets you're going to use, where you're going to sell the product, and how frequently assets need to be valued.
Thank you, John. Justin Milberg, I feel like we've been treating you as a potted plant so far. You haven't spoken in a little while, but you're going to speak now because I've got a question specific for you. And that has to do with real estate and how real estate is probably the most popular asset class that exists within a interval fund, although you can correct me on that if I'm wrong. What makes the closed-end fund an effective wrapper for real estate?
You know, hey, Mike, I'm going to just throw that question to Randy since he and I had agreed ahead of time. We both have a real estate fund and a credit fund on our platforms. But we had agreed and prepped, Randy was going to comment on the real estate side, and I'll come back and comment on the credit side when he's done.
Okay. Okay. Well, so we'll water you as long as you're going to stay a potted plant for just
a little while.
Randy, you go right ahead.
Thanks, and I won't take long. I appreciate that, Justin. So, you know, I guess you know one way to answer this question is to note that as many of you know, I'm a recovering academic, and so I used to edit the Journal of Real Estate Portfolio Management for a bunch of years. And the big thing in that journal is, you know, how do you, first of all, was to make sure and identify that real estate fit within a mixed asset portfolio, and that's obviously been firmly entrenched in the literature. But the second question is, how do you actually build the optimal real estate fund? And by optimal, what kind of real estate fund would maximize the risk-adjusted return for the investor? And kind of we talk about the low vol, low correlation, but consistent generating returns. And there's a bunch of research out there, and while it varies a little bit, the research says that a combination of private real estate securities, and the private real estate securities that both Justin and I invest in are very, very unique. These are private REITs. They themselves have a quarterly liquidity feature, so even our private securities have liquidity on a quarterly basis, which matches the liquidity of the interval fund. They're also easy to value because we do get a sponsored issue net asset value once a quarter, and that's actually a transaction price. In which we can invest. Therefore, it's a real value. It makes it very easy to value these types of private securities. And then, you know, you add those to the publicly traded REITs, and you get this great risk-adjusted return opportunity. So the interval fund wrapper, it's just a wrapper, but does a wrapper make sense? It has to make sense in construct to, does that build a good portfolio and a good product for the investor? What I would hate to see happen was, and where we wouldn't have used an interval fund, if the research would have shown that really all you want to do is hold a set of private real estate securities, and that's optimal for you, I would hate to do that and say, you know what, I'm going to force real estate into an interval fund structure, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to hold these publicly traded REITs, or I'm going to hold some money in a money market account, or I'm going to buy some generic stocks, just to meet the requirement of liquidity need of the interval fund. But here it's a beautiful and natural thing. One, we've got the public securities as part of the portfolio as well, which meets those liquidity needs. But not only does it meet the liquidity needs, the combination of the public and private together actually builds a better portfolio for the investor. So in the case of real estate, I think it's a really natural fit. And both Justin's fund and our fund, we don't hold direct buildings, we hold securities, and again, those securities have a liquidity feature too that coincide with the liquidity needs of the interval fund structure itself. So it really fits itself nicely on the real estate side, and I think that's one of the reasons that we've seen such a proliferation in real estate interval funds in that way.
So Justin, my apologies, I got mixed up there, and private credit is your wheelhouse. So really same question regarding private credit. What makes closed-end funds an especially effective wrapper for private credit?
Right. And I'll go back to comments I made on the earlier question, which is that Randy and many of the other competitors in this space are focused on a particular asset class within private credit. And again, that asset class is loans, credit instruments, floating rate credit instruments issued by private companies. And because those companies are private, they are coming to the loan market, not the bond market, where they might have to be a 10K filer in order to issue into that market. And because they are private companies and because their securities aren't eligible to trade on an exchange, they are less liquid. Even in the best of times, loans issued by private companies tend to be a semi-liquid asset class traded among a limited universe of institutional investors, including banks, including hedge funds, and including interval funds. So it is a very difficult asset class to hold in a conventional mutual fund where all the shareholders can theoretically redeem on one day. And we've had examples even in the last 2 years where there has been a run on a bank on a mutual fund, and they've had trouble generating the liquidity that's been necessary, and they've had to sell at fire sale prices. So the liquidity feature of an interval fund is ideal for the loan asset class. In addition, Not only are loans semi-liquid under the best of conditions, there are fairly regular events that have taken even that little bit of liquidity out of the market. If we think back just over the last couple of years, the Chinese yuan devaluation, the taper tantrum, Brexit, when these events have occurred, even that sort of semi-liquid conditions that typically exist in the market can disappear, and you can go to really a zero liquidity environment. So the interval fund is an ideal structure for holding these kind of semi-liquid asset classes. Randy mentioned that there's been a proliferation of real estate interval funds. It's our larger fund is a real estate interval fund, and this is true also for Randy's group. The credit fund is newer, but they're really because of the great fit between interval funds and loans. There's been an even bigger tidal wave, at least 10 products out on the market with more in registration as people have come to understand the very good match here. I would make one additional point, though. Interval funds provide less liquidity than a conventional mutual fund, but they still do provide liquidity. And as I mentioned before, that liquidity cannot be turned off. So at the same time, while we want to leverage the structure to take advantage and give retail investors access to this asset class, we still need to respect the liquidity of the fund. And we are very conservative here in resource. We continue to allocate a pretty significant portion of our portfolio to more liquid asset classes. There's lots of ways to do this. We happen to invest about 20% of our portfolio in publicly traded BDCs. 20% divided by five, that creates about a year of additional built-in liquidity to meet that 5% per quarter obligation. So on the one hand, we want to take advantage of the structure and give retail investors access to those less liquid, more stable, higher returning asset classes, but we always have to be very conscientious about respecting the wrapper. This is a new product category. Most of these funds started to come about 4 or 5 years ago, and we haven't been through a tough down cycle. We always keep that in mind.
Thank you, Justin. And John Guthrie, back to you. Let's talk advisors. How should an advisor evaluate a closed-end fund when considering asset allocation decisions?
Sure. It's a great question. I think that, first of all, they're going to begin by looking at their portfolio and the needs of their portfolio. And I think what they're going to find is that in addition to the more traditional asset classes that are building up a significant piece of their portfolio, interval funds are going to provide that access to alternative assets, be it private credit or real estate, as we just discussed. I think that if you're evaluating the fund, you want to look at what the underlying assets are, and to the extent you have a research team, you want to make sure they're looking at those assets and making sure they're appropriate for the wrapper, for either the closed-end fund wrapper or for the interval fund wrapper. And to that, I really mean the conversation we just had. Is there going to be enough liquidity to provide the needed liquidity within the interval fund structure, right? Is there going to be the pricing that's available? So that's one of the things I think you want to consider. I then think you want to consider the investment manager, right? What's their track record been? What's their experience within the asset class, which is very similar to other asset classes or structures that you would review. And then finally, I think you just want to consider the underlying asset itself, whether or not it's going to be, how beneficial it's going to be to your portfolio. And it's where I when I think about the lineup of funds that we offer, I think that they each really provide unique benefits to a portfolio that are going to provide both the, be it income, be it ability to grow the portfolio and through alternative alpha and beta, or diversification, which I think more and more advisors are going to be looking for new ways to diversify their portfolio as the sort of the old traditional ways of diversifying into different open-ended mutual funds and diversifying between large growth and large value and between managers who manage that money becomes less effective and really moves towards indexes. I think they're going to be looking for ways to diversify their portfolio. So that'd be a really important factor I would look at. How much diversification are you going to get from an allocation to a particular closed-end fund?
So Justin Milberg, how might a closed-end fund react differently from, say, an open-end fund or a traded security given similar assets inside that chosen wrapper?
Yeah, I think we're still, focused on interval funds, and I really just think it goes back to the comments that Randy and I made when we talked about why these funds are an effective wrapper. Most importantly, interval funds can hold less liquid securities, while minimizing the allocation to cash like securities. In addition, I think this is a very important point. When we do hit those market crises and more liquid investment wrappers are forced to sell, interval funds can be buyers because they are protected from the pressures of providing liquidity to shareholders all at once. Interval funds are going to be able to go and take advantage of those crisis markets to drive returns, and I think that's a very important feature.
And my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's also a credit instrument within an interval fund which allows it to be opportunistic without necessarily, at the same time, being liquid enough to go ahead and return investment dollars to investors that are saying, I'd like to withdraw my money. Is that the case, that that credit instrument exists within interval funds for opportunistic reasons?
A lot of interval funds maintain credit lines to manage cash flows and provide some additional returns. There are different strategies to managing those credit lines as you move from product to product. Somebody mentioned earlier that the 40 Act limits leverage to 33% of AUM as a protection for shareholders. But yes, many interval funds maintain a credit line to provide capacity during times of low inflows and crisis markets in order to be able to capitalize on those markets, although conventional mutual funds can hold those same types of credit lines.
So, Brandy Anderson, go right ahead.
I was just going to just add on to that. There's often a discussion which talks about the benefits of liquidity, and it sort of sits apart from illiquid investments, and investors are sort of driven to look for the most liquid option to invest because they view illiquidity as a risk. And I just think if you look at the comments that were just made, the reality is that having the ability to limit liquidity actually can really help drive long-term performance of an investment vehicle. The flows in and out of a fund can be very detrimental to the fund's performance, and the ability to limit those funds can really benefit shareholders at the end of the day. And then separately, for the end investor, often investment decisions are made around risk, right? And that risk is often perceived as a securities decline in value. And so I think there are multiple benefits to being able to maintain an investment on a long-term basis that that the traditional large cap value, large cap growth mutual fund really has more trouble driving alpha because of the fund flows in and out of the fund. And the investor has trouble driving their personal alpha because they often end up chasing performance. And I think that the interval fund allows for a good mix of liquidity, right? If you need to get money out of the fund, there are provisions for liquidity. But at the same time, I think it helps keep the portfolio manager and the investor pointed towards longer-term success and better returns.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point. Now, Randy Anderson, I can tell you that I've talked to a lot of wealth advisory firm chieftains, and one of the things that I hear over and over again is trying to get people into real assets or into alternatives can be difficult because, frankly, a lot of investors are spooked by the idea of tying their money up. And I had mentioned earlier that perhaps one of the things that make interval funds particularly popular is that there is that level of liquidity. They're semi-liquid, most of them offering an exit ramp every quarter, and in addition to that, the low minimum. So my question, I guess, is twofold. Number one, would you agree to that semi-liquid structure is an attraction, the low minimums are an attraction, but beyond that, what else is making closed-end interval funds popular among advisors and clients?
Yeah, I think the semi-liquid nature is very popular with the clients because you don't necessarily get trapped. You know, one of the problems with the traditional non-traded type vehicles are that your ability to get liquidity out is really contingent upon when the sponsor wants to decide to sell those assets. So you have absolutely no control over your exit. So people are always talking about when are we going to have a liquidity event? When's the capital going to get returned? Here the investor and the financial advisor are really in the driver's seat to determine that liquidity. So even if the fund is performing well, they may see a better opportunity that they want to reallocate that capital to, and that ability to have some of that liquidity allows to make more dynamic asset moves and not be left, if you will, to just exactly what the sponsor wants, or you sort of have to sell it in the secondary market, and we know the secondary markets are very thin for these securities. You end up losing, I would say at least probably 20% in most of those events. But I think more importantly, but these things have become so popular, is that if you think about what did individual investors have access to, and I'll just use real estate as the example. Before these interval funds, they had access to real estate. What could you do? Maybe an individual investor could buy one building. Well, then you have all your eggs in one basket. Or maybe you buy a rental home, which is really labor intensive, and again, no diversification. The other two vehicles that they had available were a publicly traded real estate mutual fund. There's nothing wrong with REIT mutual funds, but REIT mutual funds actually have quite a bit of volatility. In fact, the standard deviation of a normalized REIT fund is higher than that of a typical S&P 500 large cap fund, if you will. So it's pretty volatile. Eventually, you'll get the real estate return, but you do have those same kind of drawdown and market type exposures. In order for individuals historically to get really high quality direct product, they had to go into a pure illiquid wrapper that, again, could be 5, 7, 10 years. And many investors, given the size of their net worth and their other liquidity pieces, that just didn't make sense to do. And, also finally, many of the old school traditional private real estate investments, because a lot of times they didn't have a daily scoreboard, they actually had fairly high fees associated with them. And when you start out with a really high fee proposition, it's just harder for the investor to ultimately realize these returns. So when you go to the interval fund structure, yes, you get to control your own destiny by a large extent with respect to your exit. Two, you get access to things you couldn't have access to before. All these private real estate funds that, you know, we invest in and Justin's group invest in and others, these were products that only institutions in, you know, high net worth family offices can invest in. And now somebody for $2,500 can have access to the exact same type of assets that you would have to be, you know, half a billionaire to access before. So you're doing that also with the lower fee proposition than the traditional product. So it's been a real win. We're seeing the type and quality of alternative investments that typically were only available to individuals continually be blended and coming very, very closer to the assets and the return profiles that now individuals now have access to. And that's more and more important as all defined benefit plans are going away and mom and pop are left with building their own retirement plans. They need those exact kind of really high quality alternatives. And I think this interval fund is a bridge or a gateway, if you will, to letting those worlds come together.
And Randy, I'd just add quickly that the structure fits well in advisory accounts, which wasn't always true for the non-traded products, and that's another factor that's really driven the popularity of the product.
Oh, it really has. I mean, to try to put those in advisory accounts are very tricky. I mean, one, is there still an ongoing debate on whether they're appropriate? When you're charging advisory fees, it's really a management fee. If you buy an asset that you can't manage, in other words, increase or decrease the allocation, it's really hard to justify a management fee in some cases. More importantly, it's just hard to rebalance and allocate your holdings as you're trying to build portfolios that make sense with the changing of the economy. You know, today, let's say that people are worried that the stock market maybe has run up too high and they want to pull a little bit back and add a little bit more to alts. You can do that with an interval fund structure, but be almost impossible to do in the traditional non-traded type environment.
Right. And we and Griffin and most others do offer advisory, no-load advisory share classes, which is also a critical part of the equation.
That's right.
As do
what is the most common misconception about interval funds? And I'll make that one a jump ball, whoever wants to take that. What's the most common misconception that you hear about out in the marketplace regarding interval funds?
I mean, the thing that I guess that's toughest from my point, and there's a lot of product-specific mixed messages and wrong perceptions, but the biggest issue is that people treat interval funds all the same. And quite frankly, you could put almost anything that you want into an interval fund structure. So I think a lot of people get into the business of comparing, interval fund A with interval fund B. But for example, that could be simply comparing my real estate fund to somebody else's insurance-linked product fund. And they really have no relationship, and they really shouldn't be compared to one another. It would be no different than saying, I'm going to compare all mutual funds and take a look at how a large cap growth stock worked relative to sort of some fixed income mutual fund type vehicle. So I think the biggest misconception is that all these interval funds are kind of sort of the same investment and kind of give you the same exposures. They really don't. And I think the most important thing is that people to really look under the hood and get an understanding of what's in there, because ultimately, going back to my colleague's point, these things have only been around for a short period of time. You can't rely on short-term track records to tell you which ones are the best interval funds. You've got to look at the strategy, you got to look at the structure, and you got to look at the team. And we're only going to know, you know, not today, but it's going to take another 10 years before we know which one of these interval funds were actually the best ones and how they survived the downturn with evaluations corrected on spot, where there's plenty of liquidity to meet those demands as we go forward. So, the biggest misconceptions are people looking at sort of, short-term performance and comparing apples to orangutans in some cases.
And I would just add that I think this call is helping to clear up some misconceptions, because I think that to date there's often confusion between a closed-end fund tender offer fund and a closed-end interval fund, and while they have a lot of similarities, there are some differences. So I think that calls like this are helping to clarify that as well.
What about the semi-liquid and semi-illiquid nature of an interval fund? And I ask this question for this reason. On the one hand, an advisor or an investor can say, this is great, it's semi-liquid, which means I don't have to wait a long time, just maybe a quarter, and I can get my money out. But on the flip side, they may also be saying, this is great. This is a semi-illiquid fund. I'm going to get an illiquidity premium. does that illiquidity premium truly exist, or do you actually sacrifice some of that illiquidity premium because it is semi-liquid? You understand my question? You see what I'm saying here? We're kind of splitting the difference.
Yeah, I think the fund, you know, look, it's a good question, and these funds exist along a spectrum. I do think there is an illiquidity premium, and the further you move out along that frontier, all other things being equal, which of course is an assumption that is never actually the case, but all other things being equal, you should get a higher premium for more liquid investments. So I think we are operating along a spectrum. But I do absolutely believe that interval funds are capturing an illiquidity premium, and one way is something that's been discussed on this phone just by virtue of not having to hold a portion of our portfolio in cash-like assets to address a daily liquid vehicle, for example, we're able to allocate a higher portion of our assets to the illiquid investment and achieve higher returns. So that's just one simple way to think about how interval funds capture an illiquidity premium.
You know, if you were to look at the holdings of a bank loan mutual fund and compare it to any of our funds or any of the folks on the line, it's a tremendous difference in what an interval fund is actually able to hold. And it leads to less market volatility, and it leads to the ability to generate a higher yield on your investments. So, there's definitely a premium, and the trick is to make sure, if you keep going into fully illiquid products, you could even generate a greater premium from those assets. So it's really a matter of proper management to make sure that you have the right combination of liquidity and illiquidity. But there's plenty of room in there to generate returns above fully liquid investments.
I fully agree, and I would think that I talked a little bit about point counterpoint to it. So, for example, on the real estate side, if you were just forced to hold REITs to meet liquidity and it actually didn't increase the value proposition of the portfolio, then maybe you argue that they should be done in separate vehicles, but because they work well together and provide that premium, it makes sense. If you were simply saying, listen, I've got to hold a bucket of cash to meet these liquidity needs, that would be a drag on performance and you would lose out on some of those deals. So you got to look at the appropriateness of the assets that go into the wrapper and make sure that they, in fact, do meet the wrapper. I mean, if you took it to an extreme on the real estate side, as opposed to buying securities, let's suppose that we decided to do something different and just buy direct buildings. Well, direct buildings aren't near as liquid as underlying private real estate securities that you can buy and sell on a quarterly basis, which would mean you'd have to hold additional and more publicly traded securities, and that would change again where you are on that spectrum, and again it would change on how much of that illiquidity premium that you're able to ascertain or allocate. But I think these things are a good medium. They allow you to, again, get those things, as I started the conversation off with, that people want. It's the higher income, good appreciation, low correlation and vol, but yet you do have that liquidity feature that's so important to mom and dad. Mom and dads aren't institutions. Mom and dads don't live forever, and we don't have infinite buckets of money, so it's nice to be able to have that switch and to be able to convert something from a pure illiquid portion back into the cash that somebody may need for good or bad reasons.
So, let's have you fill in the blank here. I want to get involved in an interval fund, and you say to me, listen, if you're going to get involved in an interval fund, don't get involved unless you are prepared to spend X amount of time in that fund so that you can actually realize the benefit. What should people be thinking in terms of when they enter an interval fund, in terms of how much time they need to commit if they really want to get some benefit?
I mean, to me, even though these things have a liquidity feature, I personally think if your investment horizon is too short, you shouldn't be investing in the market You know, in any case, you might as well put your money in a savings account or a CD. So I always think there's a reasonable investment time horizon, even for pure liquid securities. But for me, I would think you're making an asset allocation play. You're saying that real estate or the high yield or some sort of credit instrument makes sense in a portfolio. I think you'd want to be at least, thinking about this thing in more of a five-year kind of hold period in order to sort of capture those benefits and build that diversification. In reality, these vehicles should be in a portfolio every bit as much as a large cap growth fund. People should be thinking about them through the duration of their investment period, more or less, depending on whether they're closer or further away from retirement.
Right, but we've been around for some of our funds have been around for less than 5 years. We do get redemptions. People's circumstances change. I agree with Randy, but it's good to know that you have the option for liquidity sooner if you need it. And I think that's really, the key attribute of the product.
Well, the other thing that's good to go ahead, and then I'll
no, I have one more question. I think that's ideal, but everybody, a lot of times you got to write your plans in pencil. So a lot of times you think that's money that you can put away for a five-year hold, and then just something comes up. I mean, life's unpredictable. So having that really, on a quarterly basis is a very, very important feature.
Precisely, and I think that's what gives so many of the investors comfort and makes interval funds popular. Go ahead. We had another panelist talking.
Yeah, Mike, this is Ken. I've got us at the top of the hour. So was there another
question
you wanted to? Yeah, shoot.
Yeah, one more. And that is the, as Randy might say, the orangutan in the room that we have not addressed is fees. Fees vary from interval fund to interval fund, but generally speaking, what do you guys say about fees? Because that's obviously critical to the investor and the advisor.
Well, they're generally speaking lower than they are on the direct products and on the non-traded products and by a significant magnitude. And I think the governor of it, obviously there's board dynamics, and so you have to justify your fees that they're within a range of competitive and comparable products. But I think the bigger deal there is that we're all raising money now with the daily scoreboard in terms of performance. So, the easiest way to address fees is just to actually show how you're doing and how you're performing. If those fees are in excess, you're not going to be able to perform. And if you can't perform, you're not going to be able to raise capital. So I think it's a natural, nice process in where we've seen a large compression in fees, which inures to the benefit of the individual investor because of the transparency of the investment vehicle.
Yeah. That was the point I wanted to make. For those who've held off, and even those who invested early, fees have continued to come down, and we'd probably expect that trend to continue over the long run. But these are pretty competitive products from a fee perspective, especially given the unique asset classes and the work that's involved relative to sort of a conventional large cap equity fund.
Very good. Ken, are we out of time here?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think we are, though it sounds like we could continue discussing this for a while. So in that vein, I would invite all of our participants to reach out to Griffin and to Pravasi and Resource if you have additional questions. And, of course, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you all to regularly read and subscribe to Real Assets Advisor so you know the right questions to ask. And with that, I'll thank all of our panelists. Randy, John, and Justin, thanks for jumping on and sharing your expertise. And, Mike, I really appreciate working with you all at Real Assets Advisor, as we will certainly throughout the rest of the year on these types of calls. And thanks for moderating. I'll end with our call next month. So February 1st is the first Thursday of February, and we'll have a call on the role of private equity in portfolio construction. So if you'd like to register, you can do that through the IPA website. You can also, there are a variety of links through Real Assets Advisor as well. Feel free to, all the registrations are up. You can put the entire series on your calendar for the rest of 2018 if you'd like. So thank you all for joining us. Thanks to the panel and Mike for moderating. Have a great afternoon, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Ken. Are we off the air?
This is John. I'm still in the conference. I don't know if we're off the air or not.